is Iconic with your hosts JM, Mark, and Nick.
Welcome to Iconic, where we talk about all things 13th Age. I'm your host, JM, and with me today is Nick.
Hey.
Mark will be here shortly, but we have a special guest for you this week, Evan Franke, who is the winner of the first Iconic podcast contest, Who is the White Dragon, is on the show today. Welcome, Evan.
Thanks very much. Glad to be here.
Well, today we are returning to our Class Acts segment, and we will be looking at the fighter and how it interacts with 13th Age. So let's head into Class Acts.
Class Act.
Welcome to Class Acts. We're actually going to start by interviewing Evan and kind of getting a feel for who our co-host is today. Evan, how did you get into gaming originally?
Well, I'm one of those guys who got in fairly early and fairly young. I could trace it back, of course, back to my love of fantasy and Arthurian fiction, which I really got from my mom. But back in 1977, they made that not very good adaptation of The Hobbit, the animated version.
Yes.
Which made me, my mother had read The Hobbit to me when I was quite young. And so I picked it back up and read it, and of course found the book was superior in every way. And so I was really primed for that genre, and I started reading The Lord of the Rings. And then this older friend of mine said, "Hey, I've got this game called Dungeons and Dragons," and it was perfect timing for that. And you know what? There's a game where I can be, you know, essentially Bilbo Baggins or Aragorn or, you know, any of those fantastic characters and fight orcs and dragons and Balrogs. I'm all for it. Let's do this. And never really looked back. Played a lot of games, having to have a real grown-up life and work and have kids of my own now. Haven't had as much time to play, but gaming is still a big part of the enjoyment of my life.
Excellent.
Do you run any games for your kids?
My son plays in my 13th Age campaign. My daughter, for whatever reason, you know, likes sports more. But I'm a big fan. She especially likes sports with sticks, lacrosse and field hockey.
Oh, fantastic!
Also a great swimmer.
All right. So what? How did you first find out about 13th Age, and what was it about it that captured your attention?
Well, I found out about it on the internet, in a particular sort of gaming theorist, a guy named Rob Donahue, who's one of the co-authors of Fate, and he also has contributed to a bunch of other games, and he blogs a lot, and he started talking about the mechanical pieces of 13th Age that he'd been observing, the icon relationship and different things that he thought were really interesting. And I just found the idea of melding sort of the traditional D20 game, which I hadn't played for a long time because I stopped playing Dungeons and Dragons before second edition and went on to play other things. My son had bought into fourth edition and played that with his friends, but I had never really been back to it. And seeing Rob Donahue write about it and sort of deconstruct the interesting pieces that were merging the D20 with the sort of what they refer to as the indie storyteller game element, I just was really intrigued with it. And then 13 True Ways, the Kickstarter came out, and I was like, I just can't not get into this. And I forked over my money, and I got my pre-release edition of 13th Age and started building ideas for a campaign and actually got it launched.
Awesome. So it sounds like you are a GM as opposed to a player.
Yeah, I tended that way. I mean, I enjoy playing, but there's almost no game that I sit down and play and enjoy that I don't immediately start thinking, ooh, what could I do with this?
I am the same way. So from a GM's perspective, what is your favorite component of 13th Age?
I love the story tools in 13th Age because you build characters and settings that immediately spark connections. I'm a game master with limited time, so rather than spending a lot of time crafting everything from the ground up, just having the Dragon Empire sort of sketched out, and then I tend to take old off-the-shelf modules, things from old Dragon magazines or Dungeon magazines, and there are immediate ways to convert those into meaningful stories for my game. The icons and the motivations that those have, and then feeding into the individual motivations expressed out of people's backgrounds and the backstories that they developed that provide really interesting stories, but also provide really interesting mechanics to play into the game. I was just really impressed with that, and I love those mechanics.
Well, we've heard of a lot of GMs having struggles with dealing with the icon relationship die and using fives, or even sixes for that matter. Do you have any examples of how you run them or how you use them at your table?
Well, sometimes better than others. I think everyone should draw a lesson that even very experienced game masters aren't going to have a perfect one-to-one relationship with what gets rolled and then what happens in the game. And I think the designers have done a good job of saying, look, icon relationships roles are important, but if you don't get to all of them in a game session, as long as everybody has fun, so what?
Right.
So I think that's the first thing to take from the game. I've certainly used them the way that I've seen in actual play podcasts and in discussions, magic items that show up to help players or hints. One that I really liked that was a five complication was a high druid relationship role. I had this group of orcs that had an owlbear that they kept as they tormented it, but they kind of kept it as a pet. And the players were induced to rescue the owlbear, and because of the five, the owlbear helped them. But of course, it was a very complicated relationship of keeping the owlbear happy enough so it didn't decide that it was also hungry and would eat the party. And that was a fun thing to sort of throw at the players.
That's very a great cool. example. How can people find you online?
Yeah, I have a Twitter account, which is not very interesting, but happy to have people check it out. It's at Eknarfer. It's my last name spelled backwards with the E-R. and I also have a blog, which is sometimes active and sometimes not very, very active. But
I know how that goes.
I'm writing up the last play session that we had. It turns out to be more, notes for myself than anything else. But if people get something out of it, I'm happy that they can come and look at it. And it's a sage among his books, all Ooh. One word, .blogspot.com.
I like that.
A couple weeks ago, we talked about the dragon and it being the iconic creature of fantasy. And I think that the fighter is one of the iconic players in role-playing games. As I've only been in role-playing games for about a year and a half or so, JM, why don't you give us an overview of the history of the fighter throughout the history of role-playing games?
When D&D originally came out, there were only three classes. You had the magic user, the cleric, and the horribly named fighting man. And thankfully, one of the first changes was changing it from fighting man to the fighter. And for, I would say, the majority of D&D, even through second edition, the fighter was kind of the easiest class to play. All you ever had to worry about was hitting things. I always enjoyed fighters in concept, but as a player, or even as a GM, it's very easy to ignore what the fighter was supposed to do. I mean, the fighter was supposed to deal damage to monsters, but really take damage for the party. But they had no way to mechanically enforce that, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it was very much it was the sort of prize fighter. You know, the name of the game is to hit and hit, get hit back. Yeah, you were sort of the buffer between the rest of the party and the frontal assault of whatever was coming out of the dungeon, particularly in the old AD&D days.
Right, and fighters started off very strong. You had better hit points, better damage, better armor class, so it was harder to hit them, they hit harder. But I would say once wizards got fireball, so I want to say that's normally fifth level, the pendulum of power swung rapidly in their camp and stayed there. Third edition tried to address that with feats. Fourth edition addressed that very well, I think, with marking, the ability to like impose a penalty on people. And in 13th Age, we have come to probably my favorite iteration of the fighter whatsoever. It still comes down to taking damage and hitting things, but you have a lot more options. Evan, now, when we talked, you said that you had played a fighter in 13th Age.
Actually, I've been just game mastering. I've got two. I had two active fighters in my campaign. One dropped out, but I definitely got to see two, you know, the broad range of playstyles that the class in 13th Age can really support.
Okay. Well, and we should probably mention before we jump into that that the fighter is kind of the catch-all phrase for a skilled warrior. So whether you're playing like a samurai, whether you're playing a bandit, whether you're playing a gladiator, for the most part, all of these fall under the fighter class archetype. Gimli, even things like, you know, the knights, some of Arthur's knights would be more fighters than paladins. I mean, paladin really is more of a, drawn more on the like the romantic idea of a chivalric knight. Your wield weapons, wield armor guy is your fighter.
So how does that differ from a barbarian, other than the whole wearing armor thing?
Evan, have you had barbarians in your game?
Not in 13th Age. Okay. Way back in the Dawn days of AD&D, of course, in Unearthed Arcana, they introduced a bunch of changes. You know, the fighter had always been, you know, the class, and then rangers and paladins considered the subclass of the fighter. And then they changed that around. They created the cavalier class, and they made the paladin a subclass of the cavalier. But they also introduced the barbarian. And so way back then, the barbarian it definitely was, you know, wear little armor. They also had this quirk of the barbarian tainted magic, which was an odd thing, and made it very difficult to run a party where you had, say, magic users and other common classes, and the barbarian who always wanted to throw the magic carpet into the fire and that kind of thing. But they were also very mobile. But in some ways, they were kind of uber fighters, you know, able to absorb even more damage and deal more damage, which sort of made it not that great a class because it kind of overshadowed, you know, the fighter's shtick, which I think is something different for 13th Age.
Yeah. Mechanically, they've divested a lot since those early days. I think thematically, a fighter is going to come from more civilized lands, some place where you can get the armor and weapons and training. Fighters tend to be more trained, whereas a barbarian is much more from the chaotic wilder lands, you know, out on the edges, tribes that are, they don't have armor, which is why your barbarian doesn't wear armor. Also, Conan is kind of more, I would almost say some of the archetypal barbarian stuff obviously comes from Conan, but it's more of a, at its root, a philosophical difference, an outlook on life that then kind of has trickled down into the mechanics. What are your thoughts, Evan?
Well, I think that's right. I think the other thing that differentiates fighters from barbarians, because you could, you know, sort of deal with, you could just have a fighter in 13th Age and you could deal with different flavors with the backgrounds and things and try to encourage different builds. But what I think the barbarian brings is mechanics that reinforce the role, the role of rage and sort of the uncontrolled fighter or combatant, whereas the fighter is with the flexible attacks and the talents that it's provided with is more of a disciplined, as you say, civilized soldier sort of archetype.
Mm-hmm.
And the mechanics, which is always the beauty underlying 13th Age, reinforce those archetypes.
Well, let's get into the mechanics. So, Nick, you pulled a quote out from the core rule book. You want to share that with us?
Yeah. On page 104, it kind of gives a very brief overview of the fighter class. It says, "A couple of class talents can make your job more complicated, but overall, playing a fighter is simple. You decide who to attack, you roll your attack, and then figure out which flexible attack you want to use." So I think that goes back to what you were saying earlier about, in general, the fighter being very simple, very damage-focused.
Mm-hmm.
You can take a lot of beating, but you can deal a lot of it out. One of the interesting things with 13th Age is that you can actually keep up with a mage now.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned that once they hit level 5 and got Fireball, then from that point on, the fighter wasn't really all that needed anymore, other than a meat shield.
Yeah.
But now, with the fighters being able to progress in their damage tracks as
mm-hmm.
well, it makes it, I think it would make it more fun to play even at higher levels.
Right. The fact that all classes damage scales with level really kind of pulls the wizard from this kind of outlier for damage into where everybody is kind of in the same general sphere. So let's talk about talents. There are a number of different options, kind of different builds. Evan, you said you saw two of them at your table. Why don't you start off by telling us what you had at your table and
Sure.
kind of what your high-level view of both of those were?
Yeah. So of the sort of three, I think, that are teased out in the talent build, I have a heavy hitter who continues to be with the campaign. And then I had an archer. But the interesting thing, of course, was the flavor that you could add onto those things. And maybe we can talk about that a little
mm-hmm.
bit more. But my heavy hitter is in some ways a classic, heavily armored, two-handed weapon, half-orc fighter. And then the archer was a half-elf, but his background's flavored him as very much a samurai archer, very much a sort of Zen-focused, precise shooting archer, which was very interesting because he actually, in many ways, was more effective than we have a ranger in the party, and people always preferred to have the samurai archer providing cover than the ranger.
Oh, interesting. Well, and that goes back to something Nick said. While the fighter is still simple, very easy class to play, it is mechanically more complex than, say, the barbarian. Or if
yeah.
you look at your 13th Age core rulebook, Rob and Jonathan have listed out the classes in order of complexity. And the fighter is still close to the top of the list for simple, but definitely nowhere near the barbarian or the ranger. So Evan talked about the archer and the heavy hitter, and actually the one that I want to play most of all is kind of more of the what is known as the sword and board fighter. Sword and shield, really all about intercepting, preventing damage to your allies. And I think that in addition to the flexible attacks, which we'll talk about, the intercept mechanic really makes the fighter viable for that role. I kind of talked about how, as a GM, became very easy to ignore fighters as they leveled up, because there was before fourth edition, there was not a whole lot of, to use an MMO turn, threat that a fighter could generate. There was no reason why a wizard would attack a fighter as opposed to another wizard. You take out the glass cannon and then... Or I still remember one campaign where end of the game, the fighter comes in with all of his magic items and my big bad evil guy cast Mordenkind's Disjunction. I don't know if you remember that one, Evan, but basically the fighter went from this incredibly awesome level 20 guy with all of these cool magic items to all of his magic was stripped from him. So he was now just a guy who could hit really hard and had no special abilities. And then I went and annihilated the wizard who could cast, you know, maximized fireballs and imprisonments and stuff like that. So Intercept is the ability that allow, and we talked a little bit about it in the episode on that we talked about movement. Intercept is the ability that if you are standing between an enemy and an ally, even roughly, when that enemy charges your ally, you can jump in and force him to engage you. And a lot, and some of the fighter abilities revolve around intercepting and jumping out so you can re-intercept. It provides a lot of tactical flexibility to the fighter. And if you're wanting to play that protective fighter, the 13th Age mechanics are going to be very enjoyable for you. So as Nick said, there's a lot of different talents, and welcome, Mark.
Thank you.
My personal favorite kind of goes in what I was saying about being a sword and board, the skilled intercept that once around as a free action, you can make a disengage check from somebody you are engaged with to intercept someone moving to attack. So you actually can jump between enemies once around. And if you're wearing heavy armor, the advantage is you take half damage from that attack. So it provides mobility. It provides a way to keep your mage alive or your other squishy party members. Not that anyone is super squishy in 13th Age.
I think it's important, too, to consider using the intercept mechanic, especially if you're a fighter. I mean, typically when you go into combat, you've got your fighters at the front. You've got your rangers and rogues kind of in the middle, and then you've got your wizards in the back, just so that the monsters kind of have to work through it from hardest to softest.
That's when I have monsters attack from behind.
Right.
Yeah, I was going to comment. It's like, it doesn't matter, Jan. They pop up wherever.
But being able to intercept might work in those types of situations where the monster's like, you know, I'm not going to deal with these people on the front line. I'm just going to go ahead and swing around or fly over them or something like that. And being able to use the skill to intercept would come in handy. Personally, I like the comeback strike talent, which allows you to, after a miss, you can take another attack as a free action. To start with, you have a -2 penalty to that attack. But if you take the adventurer feat, then you don't have that -2 penalty anymore, which I find handy because I hate sitting at the table and rolling dice and miss and miss and miss and miss. So having the comeback strike under your belt allows you to, even if you miss, you can roll again and hopefully hit that time.
I like tough as iron. And maybe I'm just prejudiced because my paladin always got the snot beat out of him. Not that it's a paladin talent, but having the ability to recover for free is very helpful, especially if you're supposed to be the guy that keeps the squishies safe.
That's right.
I need to be able to take the damage and take the damage and take the damage and, let me recover, take the damage. So that helps.
What about you, Evan?
Well, the one that I've seen very effectively used at the table, and so, you know, as a GM, it has frustrated me, but as a player, I think it would be, you know, it's a highlight, and that's the heavy warrior talent, where you can take half damage if you're wearing heavy armor, and you know you pick the attack, you know, the ogre in front of you criticals. I'm tallying the huge amount of damage. It's like, oh no, actually I'm going to take half.
It
goes from, you know, I just crushed that fighter and now I get to the squishies to, darn, he's still up. And, you know, that's really satisfying. And obviously the feat, you know, allows you to do it more. And, you know, that can be pretty exhilarating from, oh, looks like he's dead to, oh no, he's shaking it off.
Yeah.
Now he's ready to deal out some more hurt.
Yeah, I'm just going to say it again. I love the fighter in 13th Age. And, when Glorantha comes out, 13th Age and Glorantha comes out, we're going to have more fighter options that tie in with some of the specialized cultures and fields of 13th Age in Glorantha, so I'm pretty excited about that.
I am too.
Well, one of the key things that make the fighter unique in 13th Age, and kind of like we've talked, bring it up on par with the other classes, is the flexible attacks. It's a unique feature to 13th Age. Mark, do you want to tell us what flexible attacks are? How do they work?
Well, you roll to hit, and then you go, I'm going to do this. You get to pick what you want. You don't have to declare ahead of time, like in a lot of systems, this is specifically what I'm doing. You can roll and then go, oh, look, I have an odd or I have an even, depending on what you've picked. You can then, instead of wasting it, you know, kind of like My paladin. I missed. Well, you still get half damage, but you miss damage. Quite the prejudice there against them. But no, that's nice. Well, you can roll that wave because a lot of them are special if they're even or an odd, or depending on what else happens, it triggers it. So you get to pick after you roll, which is kind of neat.
Yeah. So what are your guys' favorite
maneuvers?
What are your favorite maneuvers?
I like carve an opening.
Okay. What does that one do?
Oh, the crit range expands.
Okay.
Which is good.
The guy in our 13th Age Planescape game, actually Christopher, uses that one quite a bit.
I like that. And then a dozen cuts, where you still take the bleeding damage. It's continual type thing.
Nice.
I like the damage dealers. That's why I like my guy got crushed, but he could deal out a lot of damage.
Maybe you should play a fighter next time.
Yeah.
Nick, what about you?
I liked the steady now maneuver, which allows you to gain temporary hit points equal to your constitution modifier on any natural even miss. Just as a way of staying in the game. You know, okay, you missed, but you're a little bit stronger for the next round. And so if they hit you, then you can take that much more and you're still there.
Very cool. I'm a big fan of Hack and Slash, just because of the title, but also because of the ability. It's a third level maneuver. Once per round, on a natural even roll, you can make another attack against a different person. So if you're waiting in there, even with a sword and board, if you're going to be engaging multiple people, it allows you to make multiple attacks. Evan, what were your players' favorite ones?
Well, I think one that I've seen, and this sort of is a similarly frustrating one for a GM, but great for the player, and that's the brace for it, because you know it's triggered off of a miss.
Mm-hmm.
So the GM's feeling good. The player missed. Time for the monsters to go in. Roll a critical. I picked brace for it. I'm immune to the critical this round. Jim.
Yeah.
it's a way for the fighter to keep in there and you know have something interesting and you know sort of back, exciting in the back pocket even if the principal function of dealing out damage didn't go well that round.
You know, I think I've been making my characters all wrong. I need to be making my choices on the question of what will frustrate the GM the most.
Yeah. Well, you know, Nick, I don't think you've made it that wrong. I did have your character get bit in half by a demon in Planescape, and then for good measure had him vomited up on another character.
Yeah. Before we go, I think the coolest sounding or the best named maneuver is Sword of Destiny. It's a higher level maneuver. That's the best name.
Yeah, the seven
out of all of them.
Yeah,
seven sort of destiny. Sword of Destiny.
Yeah, the fact that you can not only roll it when you roll a natural 20, not only do you do double damage, but you immediately get to heal is pretty awesome. And then it keeps the epic feat lets it drop. So with that plus carve an opening, crit plus heal is a pretty big swing in the numbers.
Oh yeah, I swing crit, I heal. Swing, crit, a heal. That's frustrating for a GM.
That would be frustrating for a GM. Well, let's talk, before we get into the background section, let's talk about alternate build. There are a number of other things that we can bring into 13th Age besides just the core rules for builds and for powers and for maneuvers. Ash Law posted on the Pelgrane site, and let's just take a quick second here and thank Nick. Nick is the one who puts all of the episodes once they're edited up on the website and then listens through and does the show notes and makes all of the blog posts for the show. So shout out to Nick as a big thank you for that. And
golf clap.
And if anything goes wrong, it's his
fault.
No, I mean, it really...
There's now a big finger pointed at me.
No, there's a lot of stuff that goes on behind the scenes, and all three of us put in the effort. So Ash's dual wielder and slayer, you have kind of your iconic two-handed fighter, two-weapon fighter, I should say. And then the Slayer seems to focus even more on what, Evan, you were talking about, the heavy armor, two-handed killer of doom.
And just for clarification, he's done a mashup of melding the ranger and fighter classes together in two different builds and two different ways that you can take that multi-class.
That's right. My campaign hosts a Slayer type, although not out of this this archetype. And I one of the fabulous things about 13th Age and the folks that put it together and continue to popularize it to us, the designers and, and creators are showing us how the components can be sort of disassembled and put back together in interesting ways. I think the dual wielder and the slayer show how, you know, not only can you work within sort of the classes that they've given, but the classes are made up of pieces that can be, you know, sort of hijacked and welded together in really interesting ways.
Right. And so, for example, Mark, your crusader following half-orc, if you had wanted to, say, take tough as iron as a class talent for the paladin, I'm sure, you know, we could have, you know, had that come up, we could have totally worked that out.
Oh, yeah, you just substitute.
Yeah, you know, exactly. Or, you know, pretty much any of the players in our 13th Age group would probably want an animal companion as a substitute for their classes. Probably just unicorns and bunnies, but, you know, still.
That unicorn, dual welder.
Unicorn and dire bunnies.
Bunny yeah. farmer.
That's right.
That has six actions every turn.
That's right. Yeah. So Nick put down multiclassing as an option. Nick, you want to talk to us a little bit about what you were thinking about for that?
Well, I just wanted to mention that it is there. There's a couple paragraphs on multiclassing, specifically about with the fighter in the 13 True Ways book. I believe it's on page 109.
Okay.
The one thing that I want to make a point about saying with the multiclassing is that if you do that and you roll and you have – basically, you have to decide which class you're going to attack with. Mm-hmm. So if you're going to roll an attack with a fighter class, then you're able to use those flexible skills that you get as a result of that, or the flexible attacks. But if you choose to fight with something else, like, let's say, the druid or
a rogue attack.
Right, exactly. Then you don't get those same flexible attacks after you roll.
Right.
So it becomes a decision point for you as a player and you as a GM to be looking for it. For them to decide what it is or how it is you're going to be attacking before you actually roll your attack, if you're going to multi-class.
Yeah. Well, there's a couple of other options for you if you're looking at things for fighters. You have 13thAge.org has the Arcane Knight for kind of a fighter mage build and a classic fighter class to pick from that kind of is supposed to feel more like the old school versions of D&D. And then if you haven't picked it up yet, 13th Age Deep Magic from Kobold Press allows you to switch out some of your talents for a school of magic. So yes, it's a lot like multiclassing where you're kind of watering down, you're trading focus of ability for breadth of ability. But if you like having the fighter mage, I highly recommend, or, you know, the blank plus mage, really, with 13th Age. Check out Kobold Press's Deep Magic for 13th Age. All right, so the other way to customize your class with any class in 13th Age is backgrounds. So, Nick, why don't you give us some thoughts on possible backgrounds for a fighter?
Again, just to reiterate, backgrounds normally are not allowed to be used in combat, so this is going to be more for flavor and a way for you to be able to play your fighter or, you know, any class for that matter, outside of combat.
Yeah, skill checks and so on.
Exactly. Now, if you wanted to do something crazy like swing off the chandeliers and swing your sword at the monster's helm, then your GM may ask you to take a skill check with an appropriate background. But usually it's just kind of gives you a feel for who your character is and a way for that you can apply so that you can participate outside of just combat. You want to be engaged in the game because you're creating a story and you're crafting that, and the backgrounds right. are a great way of doing it. A lot of the common tropes for our backgrounds are choosing like mercenaries or a gladiator, you know, that sort of thing. Even as a palace guard or something like that.
I would make tie that into what they're doing. Okay, I'm the king's bodyguard. I'm going to take Interceptor. Because I protect people.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Versus like Gladiator, I might let him take and switch out with the paladin ability of, you have to fight me, you can't disengage.
Oh, yeah, the challenge.
So something like that where it ties in with their background. I mean, I find it helps. I don't like the min-maxy, I'm going to take all these backgrounds so I can be great, but I'm going to take totally different abilities.
But like, it's also a mercenary would be good at negotiating contracts. He would be good at, you know,
tracking.
Drinking ale, looking at the late, you know, some tactics, whereas a guard would have more, he's got to have some etiquette because you're not going to be a palace guard if you're putting your foot in your mouth in front of the king. Or maybe you are. Maybe that's your one unique thing, fired from the king's service because.
Have you ever seen Caligula?
No.
The drunk guard?
Yeah. What about you, Evan? What are some thoughts on backgrounds that you've seen or that you would take as a fighter?
Yeah. Well, I think one of the great things that that the backgrounds do is that they help you build the world, of course. And so with one of the fighters that that played in my campaign, he took as a background, led a squad of the King's Rangers. Now, of course, that's a confusing, not the Ranger class, but, you know, of a military unit. And suddenly, this new military unit popped up, and between us, we defined, you know, what is this military unit that helped flesh things out and, you know, gave him access to a set of interesting things to be able to do with that. You know, they were basically special forces. And so that's fun, but that then also helps build the world. Okay, well, you know, if you're tied to this special forces group, you know, maybe they're going to have reason to call you back. Maybe it's going to give you contacts. And so just like Nick was saying, you know, you need to be more than I was a mercenary. It's like, you know, where did you serve? What did you, you know, what was that like? You know, you tie it to a region or a historical event, something that really gives flavor and helps build the world. And I love the way that 13th Age encourages that.
Well, and tying in with that, as Mark said, his favorite class to play is a fighter thief. Well, you could totally do that with just as a fighter and then build all of your backgrounds around being raised on the street, the second greatest pirate in all of the Iron Sea, because no one wants to have the first greatest pirate in the Iron Sea. There are plenty of ways to play against the fighter trope. Warrior scholar of the White Tower. Okay, well, cool. Now there's a White Tower, but now I have all of these. I have the ability to participate outside of combat in more of a scholarly role. Now, Nick, when we wrote down ways to play against tropes, you wrote down model. Are we talking like fashion model? Would you take the background like with for catwalking or
yeah, something like that?
Okay,
for acrobatics, you know, social checks, that sort of thing. I was just picturing someone who
Zoolander the fighter.
Who was definitely in very good physical shape, and all of a sudden he had a sword thrust in his hand and said, get out there and fight, and he all of a sudden found out he had muscles and knew how to use them.
I want you to play that character the next time we play 13th Age. Not gonna lie.
Well, in my own campaign, the other, what you would think of a more straightforward character, the half-orc, sort of heavy hitter, took as his background, you know, definitely a complete uh, 180 from you know that that trope. You know, he's a baker, served as a apprentice in the bake shop in the little town where he was raised, and was always talking about making croissants. And also, he put down modern interpretive dance. But basically, you know, he was the leader of festivities. You know, the chief dancer, and it helped him, you know, move between different cultures, and he had all sorts of great stories and backgrounds that again, you know, make him more than just somebody who is a meat shield who swings a two-handed club,
right?
Which he calls his tree. that was the best thing. Setting up the game, it's like, oh, like, Ari, what are you wearing? And, you know, what are your weapons? Oh, no weapon, only tree and bag of rocks.
Mark, that sounds like a character that we might have seen in some of our games.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And again, the tools, you know, you just make it the two-handed weapon. You know, you don't have to. Oh, what's the stats for a tree? It's the two-handed weapon.
Yeah, the heavy two-handed weapon.
And the rocks are, you know, sort of the medium damage weapons. And boom, you're done. And the player's happy. The GM is happy. Let's move on and play.
Yeah, one of the things I was thinking of when we were building this episode is, and again, I know we've kind of lean on this series heavily here at the show, but in the Malazan series, there is a assassin in the books called Kalam. And Kalam is not like your he is a brutish fighter assassin. He takes out the quicker, faster assassins by basically getting a hold on them and breaking them physically. He really comes off more as a fighter than a thief. And that's one of the beautiful things about 13th Age. Yes, you have your mechanics, but you're able to customize those. But really, the core of who your character is comes out through one unique things and backgrounds.
Yeah.
And so you can have a baking half-orc who hits people with a tree. You can have a brutish, bear-like assassin.
Who uses knives.
You could have Zoolander.
coming
soon. The write-up on Nick Zoolander fighter in the Dragon Empire. That would be a hysterical series of short stories.
What kind of weapon would Zoolander use? The hairbrush?
Really, really, really attractive.
The hairbrush and the plate mail loincloth?
A mirrored shield so he could always look at himself.
Mirrored on the inside.
That's right, mirrored on the inside. Well, gentlemen, any final thoughts before we wrap up?
In addition to playing the Zoolander character, the other thing I want to add to my next fighter character is something that came out of our interview with Jonathan Tweet, I believe it was, about having a one unique thing of not being able to kill anyone.
Or like a pacifist fighter.
Well, no, just that. Well, I mean, I'll get in there, lay them all low, but I cannot be the person to deal the final blow. I either knock them out or they always have one hit point left.
That's very cool.
I think it'd be fun.
I think that would be awesome.
A nice juxtaposition between who the fighter's supposed to be and who the character actually is.
Yeah.
But,
well, that's going back to Malazan, Gruntal.
Oh, yeah.
I hate armies. I hate war. He's a mortal sword. He kills a lot of people.
He kills a lot of people. But yeah, definitely do. The fighter who hates fighting would be a very interesting character to play. Well, Evan, thank you for being on the show.
I appreciate it.
Well, we are pleased to announce our second contest for the Iconic Podcast. We're calling it Get Out and Run 13th Age.
How original.
After doing our organized play episode, Mark, Nick, and I were chatting, and we wanted to do something to get organized play up and running at your local game store, and what better way to do that than with our listeners. Nick, why don't you tell us about the contest?
All right. What we are wanting you to do is to go to your friendly local gaming store and run one of the organized play adventures. And then tell us about it. We will need to know your name, the name of your gaming store, when you ran it, what adventure, and what parts of that adventure, and then a maximum of 300-word write-up of what happened. And it would be great also if we could get a picture of your group so we can see what your table looks like.
We'll post all of the entries on the website. Winners will be determined randomly. But each session that you run will count as a separate entry. I mean, you'll have to put a separate entry together, but you can enter multiple times, but you can only win once. And what kind of contest would it be without prizes? Mark, tell us about our prizes.
Okay, we're graciously allowed to offer the first place winner $20 used on Pelgrane's Press website. Second gets 15, and third gets 10. Remember, you can only win once, but the more you enter, the greater chance to win that first prize.
That's right. So when you're ready to submit your entry, jump over to iconicpodcast.com. There will be a post that has a link to a Google form that will just allow you to fill out all of that and submit it. In fact, that is the official way to submit entries for this contest. All other ways will be looked at and then promptly discarded. This contest will run between now and March 31st. We're giving you just over 2 full months to get into your game store, get a group going. Winners will be announced by April 6th. Get out there and game. Well, you've been listening to the Iconic Podcast.
If you have any questions or comments, you can contact us at whitedragon@iconicpodcast.com or call and leave a voicemail at 720-924-1706.
And check out iconicpodcast.com for news, updates, and new episodes.
Thanks for listening.